And good Saturday afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Paul Lisnick Show here on the Talk of Chicago, 1690 WVON. A jam-packed show for you today. I'm so glad you're with me. You're going to want to probably chat with the guests I have on today. Remember our number, 773-591-1690. Coming up a little later in the show, Dan Rather, legendary newsman Dan Rather, will be with me talking about the politics of the day, and also we'll be talking to author Robert McClory, an author of a new biography on Father Michael Flager, and Father Flager is supposed to join us as well if he can get out of his service. But first, joining me, I tell you what, I'm like a little kid again because I get to talk to one of my favorite people who has a new book out called Growing Up Laughing. Before I tell you who it is and bring her on, I'm going to let you listen to a little theme song and see if you remember this. All right. That is, of course, the theme from That Girl, one of my favorite shows growing up. And joining me now, the author of Growing Up Laughing, actress Marlo Thomas. Marlo, welcome to the Paul Lisnick Show on the Talk of Chicago.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so happy you're with me. And again, and I'll tell you, I've read a lot of biographies, a lot of autobiographies, and I have read yours. I don't know if you know this, but a lot of radio hosts tell you they've read, but they haven't. But I did. I read the book. And this is one of the most unusual autobiographies I've ever read, because it's not just your story, it's dialogues with some of the great comedians of our day. Talk to me about the structure of the book. Really unusual.
Well, you know, I started to write it as I wanted to look at my life through the lens of comedy, because that was really my life. I grew up laughing, literally. That's why I called the book Growing Up Laughing. And as I started to write about how I grew up, I thought to myself, I know how I got funny and why it pleases me to tell jokes and I find the funny in things. How did all these funny people like Jon Stewart and Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock and Whoopi Goldberg and all of these people, Joy Behar, how did they get the funny? So I decided to ask them, and it was interesting because just like me, everybody that's funny has a funny person in their family, either a mom or a dad or a grandpa or an uncle, somebody in their family that made them laugh and that they wanted to make laugh. And I think that's really a secret about all of this. If you have somebody who makes jokes in your family, you're bound to have a better sense of humor than people that did not have that in their childhood.
And, of course, you couldn't have had a better teacher because, and I guess it depends on the ages of our listeners out here, but we do have a lot of folks who are of the proper age who remember, of course, your father is the phenomenal and legendary Danny Thomas.
Thank you. And yeah, absolutely. You know, growing up with a comedian, my father was fabulous and a great comedian. But no matter who the comedian is, I mean, Jerry Seinfeld's children, Jerry Seinfeld told me that his daughter carries around a book that's called a Jokepedia. So without her even knowing it, she has the desire to make people laugh. And she said to him, Dad, I love making people laugh. And I said, what did you say when she said that to you? And he said, I know the feeling. So she's getting it from her dad.
You know, some of the, I think of Joan Rivers today or Bob Hope from yesterday. They all had joke catalogs, literally card catalogs full of jokes. Did your dad do anything like that?
Yeah, sure. He had his stories. He didn't tell one-line jokes, but he certainly had his stories. And I think all the comedians have to. You know, you've got to have a place. Jay Leno's got to be saving his jokes. Everybody does, of course.
And your father, of course, was known for the long stories. I mean, it was just just so great. And but also there's some, you know, again, references people may not get. Today, you'll hear something in The Golden Girls, directed by your brother, produced by your brother, Tony.
Right. The
great reference to the Danny Thomas spit take. So tell us, so even, you know, a lot of people know the phrase but don't realize what that means. So can you put it in words for radio?
Well, I think I can. You know, what it was is that if something funny is happening and you're drinking a glass of water or a cup of coffee or even, you know, having a cigar in your mouth, when you laugh, you know, the cigar spits out of your mouth or the coffee, you know, and we've all felt that. You know, you'll be drinking something, Coca-Cola or something, and somebody says something funny, and the Coke goes up your nose, you laugh so hard. And that's kind of the idea of what a spit take is that you spit it out. But I remember I did this once on the David Letterman show. David Letterman asked me if I could do a spit take. And I said, well, I've never done one, but I think I can. I mean, I thought to myself, what's the big deal? You start to drink a glass of water, you spit it out. So I did it. And my father called me that night, and he said, honey, you don't spit, you blow. So then I said, okay, Daddy, you know.
You did a spit take, but you didn't do a Danny Thomas spit
take.
That's
right. So then I thought, well, I don't know how often I'm going to be doing this, but okay, now I know it. I blow out the water. I don't spit the water.
I love it. And, of course, you know, listen, our audience, while we're playing all over the country, but we do have primarily a Chicago audience, so it's fair enough to say that for 30 years you've been married to one of Chicago's favorites, Phil Donahue.
Right, of course, yes, and we're proud of it. You know, there's not many of us left in Hollywood that have had a 30-year marriage, and we're proud of the fact that we've been able to achieve that. And I, you know, everybody says to me, what's the secret? I said, I don't know that it's a secret. It's kind of obvious, you know, be interested in each other and take care of each other.
And I remember when I was growing up, there was a movie theater here named the Old Orchard Theater. It's gone now. And I used to be an usher there. And I remember Phil came in one day. It was before you. He came in with his kids from his first marriage to see a movie. And it was just, it's the place just stopped. Everybody just stopped and stared when Phil Donahue walked in. That striking white hair, just amazing.
I know.
But let this book, Growing Up Laughing, and I'm so glad you're on today because, you know, people who are thinking of Christmas gifts, I mean, this is a great gift because even, and I'm going to be honest, even if you say, well, I don't remember that girl, Marlo, you don't have to because all you really have to do is love comedy to appreciate this book.
Yeah, and Jerry Seinfeld and Robin Williams and Lily Tomlin and Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and Chris Rock and all these great comedians talk about comedy and tell jokes. So Robin Williams couldn't stop telling jokes. And I've written them all in there because I really wanted to do a book that will make you laugh. And this book is going to do that.
And it does. And one of the interesting things, and I mentioned Joan Rivers, and she's one of your conversations. I love the one
you
have.
I love her.
Yeah.
I just love her.
And with Don Rickles as well. What you do is, and I'm curious why you decided to do it, you actually put the transcripts in of your phone conversations. And, of course, Don Rickles is Don Rickles. He starts attacking Phil and everything in the conversation.
I didn't do that with every interview.
No.
I did that with Don Rickles, and with Joan Rivers, as you mentioned. But with a lot of them, I put them in story form. Alan Alda's I did in story form. In some of them, I did them in a Q&A like Playboy magazine used to do. I did them in different ways because I didn't want it to be boring. I wanted it to have, you know, I'm an entertainer at heart, so I wanted it to have a way of really capturing people. And what I think is great about it is for anybody who loves to laugh and tell jokes, it's all there. If you like if you want to understand how to be a comedian, if you want to understand, you know, what is the craft of comedy, that's there. To hear Jerry Seinfeld talk about how he creates a joke is it's just fascinating to me. And so a lot of people are getting it for different reasons, but I think there isn't anybody on your Christmas list who isn't going to want to read something that's about laughing. God knows we could use it in this world.
That's right. Again, my guest is Marlo Thomas, the author of Growing Up Laughing. If you have questions for Marlo, you want to reminisce, 773-591-1690. You also have some touching moments. I mean, what I noticed, Marlo, is a couple of things were very clear. When your father passed away, that was incredibly powerful for you. I mean, you literally talk about, you know, just getting down and rocking. You had a tough time with that.
Well, first of all, he was not sick.
Yeah.
So his death was a shock. He died in a half an hour. And I don't think there's any good way for anybody to lose a parent.
No.
And so whether they go fast or slow, both ways are painful. But we only know about it going fast, and going fast was really difficult for us because we just weren't prepared for it at all. We had made no peace with it, so it kind of just knocked us over. It was really like being hit in the head with a plank. I mean, we were just completely blindsided, so that was very hard.
I was also touched, and here's proof I've read your book. I was also touched by the fact that after your dad's funeral, you and your brother Tony went to see the house that you grew up in. You went to visit the
and
old
my
house.
My sister Terry, three of us.
Would you talk about that? Because it's just an incredible story, and it sounded like it was a surprise even to you.
Well, we had all these people over, and they were all trying to make us laugh, and they were reminiscing and everything. And at one point, we looked at each other and said, let's go visit the house on Elm, the house that we grew up in. And we went there, and we knocked on the door, and we said, is this crazy? I mean, they're going to think we're nuts and want to come in our house, our old house that we grew up in, because my parents had moved away like 20 years before. Anyway, we knocked on the door, and this nice blonde lady answered the door, and we said, we're the Thomas kids. We grew up in this house, and our dad just passed away, and we had this really, you know, crazy yearning to just come in this house again. And she said, oh, I've been expecting you. And we said, what? well, why would you be expecting us? And she said, oh, your dad used to drop by all the time and have a vodka with us.
And you never knew.
Flabbergasted, and we thought, you know, that's our dad, sentimental daddy. He had gone there. We had all loved that house, a great deal, and he had beat us to it. He'd been there for years, having a drink over there. He loved that house.
You talk a lot, and I couldn't wait to get to the chapters where you did deal with that girl, because I have to say, I'm still a fan of that show. I have it all on DVD. And,
oh, that's great.
And thank goodness it's out. But, you know, here's what people forget, because you were really a pioneer in doing a show. These days, you watch a show about a single woman in New York and an actor, and it's like, yeah, you know, what else is new? Not when you
did. Right.
When you did it,
right.
Well,
I mean,
new.
In those days, yeah, it was very revolutionary. I mean, there had never been a single girl on television before. This was before the Mary Tyler Moore Show and Kate and Alley and
Murphy Brown
and all those shows. They hadn't been on yet, of course. So we, as Billy Persky, who created That Girl, said, that girl threw the hand grenade in the bunker and everybody else got to walk right through it. And then later he produced Kate and Alley, so he knows what he's talking about.
That's
yeah,
right.
So that was... It was very revolutionary. It was hard to get on the air. But the exciting thing is that once it got on the air, it had a big audience. I mean, girls were waiting for this. They wanted it. And we were thrilled to, you know, to catch the wave of really what was happening in the country with women.
I've always wanted to ask this. Your character name, of course, was Anne Marie. Your last name was Marie. But throughout the entire series, you have to sort of deal with the fact that Marie sounds like a middle name. It's not your last name. Was that part of the original, you know, plan? In other words, why didn't you give yourself a name like,
well,
you know, Ann Jones?
Yeah, that's the way Persky and Dunlop wrote it that way on purpose. They thought it would be funny to have her deal with that all the time. Yeah, that was their idea.
And part of it,
they liked the idea that she'd always have the problem of people not knowing what her name was.
I also love in the way you write Growing Up Laughing. It's you really are just talking to us, because we get to know the people in your life, and even people like Kathy Berlin, your publicist, who I've gotten to know well in the last few weeks.
Right.
And but just you talk.
And also how I met my husband, and how Phil and I fell in love on his show, and how I met Gloria Steinem and Bella Abzug, and why I created Free to Be You and Me for my niece Dion, and how that girl got created, and Ted Bessel as Donald, and in fact I named that chapter O'Donnell.
That's right.
So all of the parts of my life, but I try to do it all in a fun way. I mean, there were places where I couldn't help but get emotional when I talked about my dad or my dad's passing, or talking about the kids of St. Jude. I mean, it really is, you know, the whole story of my life, but done in a way that I wanted it to be fun and entertaining, and also bring in these great comedians, because that's what I really care about. I care about comedy.
You do. And, of course, I love even the inside stories when you and Ted, who you call Teddy, Teddy Bessel, had the discussion when he went on to do the show The Chimp and I, but his agent got the name changed to Me and the Chimp because he didn't want to. He played second billing to you for 5 years, didn't need to do it to a monkey.
I know. Wasn't that so funny? That really made me laugh. That's why I wrote about it.
He was another
one.
He died suddenly as well, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. He had a ripped aorta. He died of the same thing John Ritter died of, which I guess is hard to diagnose. That's why these guys, you know, die of it, because Teddy had gone to the emergency room with pain in his chest, and they did a cardiogram, and it didn't show, and then he went home and died. And I asked a doctor friend, I said, how did that happen? And he said, well, if you have pain in your chest, get a chest x-ray. So I'll pass that on to your listeners. If you have a pain in your chest, a cardiogram isn't going to show everything, but a chest x-ray will show it.
One of the things very important to you, of course, was a mission your father began, St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, which is in Memphis, Tennessee. I mean, your dad founded it back in the early 60s. That has really, I mean, you are very involved, and I think you've just done something with NBC and Matt Lauer for that. Talk to me about the importance of St. Jude and how it's just stayed in the limelight all these
years. St. Jude Children's Research Hospital was founded by my dad in 1962. To take care of children who have cancer and other catastrophic diseases. And we are the only cancer hospital in the country for children that really has research and treatment under one roof equally, so that every child comes to St. Jude and has both a scientist and a doctor working on their case. And my dad made a promise that no child would ever be turned away if a family couldn't pay, which is great, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing, but it also means that we have to raise a lot of money. It costs us $1.5 million a day. So we're in the middle of our Thanks and Giving campaign, where I encourage your listeners to go shopping at Williams-Sonoma and the Pottery Barn and CVS Pharmacies and Dick's Sporting Goods and Domino's Pizza and Kmart and Target and all these wonderful Brooks Brothers, all these wonderful stores that are going to ask you to put a dollar down for the kids of St. Jude. And it's just a dollar. But last year we raised $65 million in 3 weeks.
Wow. Now, this is the seventh year. You began that program in 2004.
Yeah, right.
You're in
your seventh year. Right. And so far we've raised $185 million.
Now, is there a website where people can go and check the stores that are participating?
Absolutely, stjude.org. And speaking of websites, please, anybody that's listening, any women, go to marlothomas.com and join me in all kinds of wonderful conversations that matter to women about money and love and romance and kids and grandkids and beauty and aging and all of it. It's all there, and I hope you will join us because we're having a great conversation. It's on AOL. I love AOL. They're my partner. Oh. And I'm having a wonderful time.
And can we? I just want to revisit as well. You wrote 5 best-selling books. I remember Free to Be You and Me and Free to Be a Family. And what was the impetus behind, and there's others, of course, but the impetus behind, you know, those books, and you went to write Grammy-winning, CDs on those topics. It, really about a message for kids.
Well, yeah, when my sister's daughter was born, she was the first grandchild in our family. She was around 5 years old, and I was reading books to her, and the books were really so terrible. I mean, they were, you know, kind of reinforcing what my sister and I had grown up with, that, you know, someday the prince will come and make it all better. Well, we all know the prince is not going to come and make it all better. We're all going to make it better together. That's how you have a good marriage. That's how you have a good life. And so I said to my sister, this whole thing about, you know, the Cinderella and the slipper and all, you know, where's the stuff that's going to make her feel that she can be anything she wants to be. And so she said, well, I couldn't find it. So when I went to the bookstore and I couldn't find it, I thought, I'm going to make a little record for Dionne that just for her that sings and tells stories about being her own person and how there's anything she wants that she can be free to be. And the same for my nephew, who was also born like a year later. And he could be free to be anything he wanted to be, and that was all right to cry. I had Rosie Greer, this big, fabulous athlete, football player, singing It's All Right to Cry. It was about really liberating children from sex stereotypes and racial stereotypes.
The message is still powerful today.
Yes, it is. It absolutely is. And they're doing it in schools. Every place I go, every city I go to raise money for St. Jude or to do a play in different cities, there's always a note for me left by a teacher of some school saying, we're having a production of Free to Be You and Me. Would you come and see it? And often I do go and see it, and it's just enchanting.
And listen, you've mentioned so many of the young comedians, the Seinfelds and the Chris Rocks who are out there, and of course that relates a lot to our audience. But I want to ask you about the generation that I grew up with, and a lot of our listeners did, and you did. I mean, when you would come home from school, so to speak, sitting around your table was Sid Caesar and George Burns and Bob Hope and Milton Berle. I mean, these
right.
Did you get that when you were a kid? I mean, you know, I didn't have famous
parents. I didn't get that they were famous because I was just a kid, but I got that they were funny. They're my dad's funny friends. And so when I would go out on a date in my teen years even, I'd be looking at my watch to think, I want to get home by 11:30 while the guys are still in the living room smoking cigars and having brandy so that I could be in on the jokes because they're just so funny and great. And they were generous too. I mean, nobody ever shushed us out of the room. We'd come in and sit on the floor and listen to them tell stories, and they'd laugh like mad, such belly laughs, and it was so much fun. And you know, I'll tell you the truth. To this day, I surround myself with friends who are funny, and we all laugh. We play games. We laugh. We go to comedy clubs. On my birthday, my husband said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "I want to go to a comedy club. I want to laugh. I want to have a good time and laugh." And laughing really perks you up, you know, it really does put oxygen back in your body, and it makes you feel good to laugh. And it's hard to be mad or upset when you're laughing.
And, of course, everybody talks about your dad because, he was the best, but let's give a moment to your mom. I mean, she sang, right?
She was wonderful.
Tell us a little bit about your mom.
The best thing about my mother, aside from the fact that she was adorable and fun and everything, was that she really kept our family together. And I think, you know, it's unusual for a couple in Hollywood to be married 55 years, and they were And I think basically because my mom went out of her way to keep the family together. We went to Catholic school, and she would go to the nuns and ask the nuns if we could have a Friday and a Monday off so that we could go visit my dad at, you know, wherever he was appearing in a nightclub, at the Chez Paris in Chicago or the Sands Hotel in Las Vegas or the Fountain Blue in Miami. She made sure that we spent several weekends with my dad so that the family was together. I mean, she could go visit him all the time, too, but she wanted him to have the whole family experience. And he never missed a Christmas. We were always home to each other for Christmas. And on Thanksgiving, we often had to go to Las Vegas or Chicago or somewhere to spend Thanksgiving so that we could be together. But my mother, that was what she did, and it was pretty amazing when you think of it. Pretty amazing accomplishment.
Very much. And so would you travel with your dad? I mean, how much did you see him, or was he gone?
No, that's my point. Mother made sure that we were together.
The kids were there. Okay. So you were all there as well. And in fact, you did have a story with, I think, with Tony, where he had gotten into some trouble, and then his punishment was...
My point is that my dad traveled in nightclubs, but my mother made sure that we were there as often as we could be. The holidays were always together, and our birthdays and so forth.
Gotcha.
But, and he wasn't gone all the time, but he was gone a lot. And so we had four-day weekends that the nuns gave us off on a Friday and a Monday so that for 4 days we could get to my dad and back. So that was very important. So we didn't feel the sting of nobody loved us. You know, we really felt that everybody went out of their way. Our parents went out of their way to be sure that we were together as a family, and that's a big deal.
Do you think, when you read the book, I mean, growing up laughing, and you get the sense of the old, and it's filled with jokes, too, by the way, lots of jokes.
Yeah.
You just take these breaks and have jokes, and there is funny.
Well, because they always go with the story just before it.
Exactly. But the comedians of today, and I know you've been asked this, I'm sure, before, but, you know, look, humor is dirtier today. It's more sexual today. You know, the comedians of yesterday never went there. Has society changed? I mean, what has changed that makes that today's humor?
Well, I think the taboo has changed. In my dad's day, they made sexist jokes. They made racist jokes.
That's
true.
They
made Polish jokes. But they didn't tell dirty jokes. Today they tell dirty jokes, so they don't make sexist jokes, they don't make racist jokes, they don't make Polish jokes. So the taboos have changed. So I think, to tell you the truth, I'd rather they tell blue jokes than talk bad about groups. I think that's better.
You know, you make a great point. It's just right. It's a part of the culture and the time in which we live.
Right, exactly.
And by the way, I saw Phil was recently on Oprah's show as that genre changes, just out of curiosity. Because you do get
so
much.
That was so nice.
Wasn't that great?
They showed such respect for Phil.
Yeah.
Oprah has very great respect for Phil and often says how if it wasn't for Phil, there would be no Oprah. And I appreciate that respect that she has for him and all of the talk show hosts that were on, Geraldo and Sally, Jesse Raphael and Montel Williams, they all said the same thing. I mean, Phil is... he's my husband, but let's face it, he is the king of talk. There's no two ways about it.
There's
he created it. He invented that form. Until Phil came along, everybody had a band and a couch, and they didn't talk. They just, they did a lot of stuff. But he had the courage to do that, and he did it for 29 years, longer than anyone, and including Oprah, who's quitting after 25. But she's had a great run. She's fabulous, Oprah.
Yeah.
She's a fabulous a person of ideas, and she brings people together, and she inspires people, and she's great. But Phil did something else, which is to really look at the woman of America and say to her, I'm going to bring you real information.
Yeah, well,
that's what he did, and he brought the women's movement and the civil rights movement, and he brought Ralph Nader, and he brought General Motors, and he brought into the living rooms of American women everything that all citizens should be concerned with, and that's what I think is his greatest, really his greatest achievement, that he didn't bring women's issues. He decided that every issue was a woman's issue, whether it was finance and the budget of the country or whether it was war or not war, whether it was, Ralph Nader and General Motors having a fight, That's what I thought was interesting about what Phil did, and nobody has ever done that except him.
I agree, and let Phil know we'd like to have him on the show one day soon and,
Absolutely. And
reminisce. The book is Growing Up Laughing, My Story and the Story of Funny. Marlo Thomas, there's no better Christmas book to bring a smile to people's face and all that. And by the way, my next guest, he can actually hear us now. In fact, we're going to join him, is the legendary newsman Dan Rather. Have you ever talked to Dan Rather?
Of course, he's fabulous. Why wouldn't I talk to him?
Dan, are you on with us?
I am indeed.
Oh, well, let's have a kumbaya moment. Dan, any message for Marlo there?
I certainly will. Dan's a wonderful man. He's got a great legacy of news. He was in the early days of television news, he didn't let anybody get away with anything. I remember you at the White House asking every tough question. What a legacy Dan Rather has.
Well, thank you, Marlo, and good luck with the book.
Thanks so much. All right, good luck, happy holidays, and I wish you all a healthy new year.
Thank you. Marlo Thomas, Growing Up Laughing, our best to Phil. Thank you, Marlo. Happy holidays. All right, and you know, I didn't mean to do that to you, Dan, but I thought, what fun to put Marlo Thomas and Dan Rather on the phone together for a first.
Absolutely. Anytime I can be on with the great Marlo Thomas, I'm honored.
Well, and joining me now, I had the pleasure to meet you, Dan, in New York when we attended the Cable Facts Award ceremony. Both came home with trophies, happy to say. And I have so admired you and your work for so long that it's a true honor and privilege to have legendary newsman Dan Rather on with me. And again, Dan, welcome to the Paul Lisnick Show.
Thank you very much, Paul, and thank you for those kind words.
And my pleasure. You, of course, host HDNet, which airs in Chicago. I'm going to say it again, but if you've got Comcast at home or DirecTV or Dish, whatever you have, you get HDNet, and that's where you're hosting a show. And Dan, to just talk for a moment, if you want to talk to Dan Rather, you know our number, 773-591-1690. What an opportunity to speak to a legend, so feel free to call in. Dan, going from CBS and the years you had there, I mean, the restrictions are gone. Do you feel free? Talk to me about what it's like to be in the HDNet cable world versus CBS.
Well, it's tremendously liberating, Paul. I had a great run at CBS News. I was there for 44 years, 24 years as anchor and managing editor of the Evening News, 60 Minutes, the whole thing. But this experience of moving digital, if you will, moving into high-definition television with Mark Cuban's HDNet has been so liberating that my arrangement with Mr. Cuban, who owns the whole thing, that is the whole network,
right. Is
that I have complete, total, absolute editorial and creative control. This is rare, if not unique, in American journalism, and it has been tremendously liberating that we specialize in hard-edged investigative reports and international reporting. And the opportunity to do what I want to do, when I want to do it, how I want to do it, for better or for worse, I just can't describe to you. It's one of the most joyful periods of my professional career.
And, of course, I also enjoy you. We get to see you every other week or so on Chris Matthews' show on Sunday mornings when it airs. It also lets you sort of get out and just speak your mind. Now, you don't fear speaking your mind anymore, do you?
Well,
I'm not sure
true.
You ever did, actually.
Well, I'd like to think I never did, but it's true that being on the Chris Matthews program on Sunday morning, where they sort of kick the political ball around, gives you an opportunity to say what you think and what you think might happen when we talk about, you know, who might run in 2012. Well, you're free to give your own guesses, wrong as they may be.
Exactly. But I love listening to you anyway, because I'm a political analyst here and you inform me. So when I'm on the air, I can keep that in mind as well. And I know, by the way, I'm going to talk about some of the topics you have coming up on your show this week. I want to do that. But of course, I have to talk to you. Here we are just this morning. The Senate came through as it always does, right? Unable to pass legislation or to pass any kind of motion dealing with tax cuts for the middle class. What's your take on, is the president cooked in 2012, do you think that he can turn this around and somehow bring back his base? He's lost the base. He's lost the middle. What's he got to do?
Well, the president is in a very tough situation, and I think he has some months, probably nothing more than 8 to 12 months at the most, to turn around not just the perception of his administration, which is very important. Sometimes perception is as important as the substance, but also to turn around the substance. If he's not able to turn it around in the next 8 to 12 months, number one, he's very likely to have some Democratic opposition in the primary in 2012 if he decides to run then. Then he also will be faced with the decision whether to try to bring somebody else on the ticket besides Joe Biden,
That's
whom
right.
he likes and who's done a good job. And then the prospects for his election in 2012 right now, at this moment, do not look very good. But as you and I both know, Paul, overnight is a long time in politics. That's a week is forever, and we're talking about elections almost 2 years away.
And look, if you look at this point in Bill Clinton's first term, the impeachment was going on. Very few people thought he would get a second term.
Well, that is very true. After the off-year elections of 1994, it looks as if his goose were cooked. However, I will say that President Obama, whom I personally admire, and as a person I have interviewed him and talked to him, he's a very nice man, obviously a very bright guy, very emotionally stable, all of those things. However, he is not the experienced, very experienced, and even gifted politician that Bill Clinton was and remains. And so I think he has a steeper hill to climb, and it's an open question of whether he has the goods to get out of the mess that he's in. It's not entirely a mess of his making.
I found this interesting just yesterday. Of course, he did a surprise visit to the troops in Afghanistan. And I don't know if you were watching this at all, but on NBC, they said, well, he's supposed to meet with Helmut Karzai, but they're saying weather's keeping him from doing it. And then they said, but the weather's fine here, so we wonder if there's something more to it. Within minutes, Dan, Robert Gibbs, the press secretary, makes his way to NBC to say it is the weather, and he speaks to it. My point being, they know exactly what the media is talking about. So he has to be, he's got his people on the pulse of everything. And what everybody's saying is, Mr. President, why don't you, instead of compromising with the Republicans, and something he said again today, we're going to compromise, why don't you say it's time to do it our way? He's got to be hearing that message, but he's not doing it.
Well, he is not doing it, and I think this is my opinion, including the Labor poll. I think this is right at the core of his problems, that people felt they knew Obama during the election campaign, and that's the reason he got elected. Since he's been in, there's been a distancing between him and the population as a whole, and part of that distancing is people are asking themselves, and this includes most especially people who are firm believers in President Obama, who want him to succeed. The question is, what does he stand for? What is he really willing to fight for? And since the November elections, he's been collapsing on almost every front, sort of giving in every front. Perhaps there's a strategy behind this, but if there is, so far it's not apparent and it's not working. But it's that question of people want the president to be compassionate. They want him to be sensitive, but they also want him to be a fighter. You may remember, Paul, you're younger than I am and may not, that President Harry Truman, after the Republicans scorched him in the 1946 off-year elections, he came out fighting and became known as, you know, fighting President Harry Truman. And he called the Republicans every name in the book that was half-decent and some that were not so decent, half-decent. And he got a reputation of being a fighter, which is one of the reasons he prevailed in the 1948 election campaign against all odds. And with President Obama, at some point, he's got to stand and say, this is where I stand. I can stand no other place. I'm going to fight. Up to now, he hasn't really done that, and I think it's hurting him tremendously.
I think you're right. I want to talk to you about your topic for this week, but you know what, Dan? I think it's such a rare treat when you do a radio show and people get to ask you a question. I've got a whole bunch of calls. I'm going to just grab one. I want somebody to be able to ask you a question from out there, if that's okay with you.
Sure, absolutely.
All right, so joining me now, Ron from Chatham. You're on with Dan Rather, the legendary newsman. I know you've got a question about opinion shows, Ron. Go ahead. Ron, are you there? Oop, did I hit a wrong button? All right. Well, I don't know what. Oh, okay. I got to hit the right. There we go. Ron, you with us?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. First of all, it's a pleasure and honor to speak to Mr. Rather. I tell you, professionalism, man, is just impeccable. So, my question to you, Mr. Rather, when you look at a lot of shows now, talk shows, information shows, and people sometimes interpret those as being news shows, which requires a lot more facts and a lot more research. So, I want you to, you know, to comment on that. It seems to be a lot more of those shows as opposed to just real news shows, the type that you did. And again, it's a pleasure speaking to you, sir.
All right.
Well,
thank you, Ron.
Thank you very much for your kind words. And let me come directly to your question. That I've been saying for 5 years that American journalism is in crisis. And I think it is in crisis for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is the growth of the Internet, and no one has figured out a business model where they can make money out of real journalism on the Internet.
Right.
But exactly to your point, there has been what I call the corporatization, the politicalization, and the trivialization of news to the point that most programs on television that describe themselves as, quote, news programs are not, quote, news programs. They're talk and opinion programs. The reason for that is they are cheaper to do, much less expensive to do. You don't have to have reporters out in the field. You don't have to have reporters covering the war, digging into investigative reports covering Washington. All you need to do is get two or three people in a room, sometimes just one person in a room, shouting off opinions. That's entertaining, but it's not news. And that's what's happened to so much of American journalism. And by the way, I do not accept myself from this criticism. And as a consequence, the whole basis of our country, a free and independent, truly independent, fightingly independent when necessary, press, is the red beating heart of democracy because it keeps citizens informed. The press as a whole in the main is not doing its job now, and I think that's right at the heart of your question. And part of the reason is the tremendous corporatization of news, which is a very few, very large international companies now own about 80% of the true national distribution of news. Then we've had the politicalization of news, tremendous alliance of power between the big corporations and the power in Washington, whether it be Republican or Democrat. And bluntly put, very big business is in bed with very big government. And in many ways decides what it is you see and don't see. I would argue that whether you're a Republican or Democrat, whether you consider yourself a liberal, a conservative, a Tea Party member, or a mugwump, that's not what we want in this country. But by and large, that's what we have. And then we have the trivialization of news, which is to say that so much of what now passes for news is what Lindsay Lohan is doing at some moment or Brent D. Spears is doing at some
right.
moment, rather than these young men and women of ours who are fighting and dying in places like Afghanistan and Iraq.
It doesn't make any sense. And, of course, we have the 24-hour news cycle. We've got Fox and MSNBC and all the channels. So, you know, the days of the CBS, NBC, ABC straight news, although you always set the agenda, but nevertheless, the sort of straight reporting of the news, we don't have that anymore. We've got news 24-hour a day, and I'm one of the suckers who sits and watches it because I'm a part of it.
Well, if we really had 24-hour news, I'd be very pleased. But basically, we have
24-hour commentary.
We have about 23 and a half hours of entertainment passing as news, and once in a while get a little real news.
You're 100% correct. All right, we're going to take a very quick call from Marcus on the South Side because our time is running short. Marcus, go ahead with a quick call with the legendary Dan Rather.
Thank you. Thank you both. And Merry Christmas to you. And Mr. Rather, this is just such a pleasure, I mean, to speak with you here. I have a question, sir. I'm a teacher, and sometimes I show eyes on the prize. And at Dr. Martin Luther King's assassination, I think he reported, if I'm not mistaken, about his assassination. Could you tell quickly, I don't know if you would or not, who do you think killed Dr. King? Was it just the private Ku Klux Klan, or was it a government conspiracy? And thank you so much, and Merry Christmas to you.
Thank you, Marcus. What do you think?
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, and Merry Christmas to you, and I appreciate your kind words. I spent a fair amount of my professional life during the late 60s and early 70s investigating the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. As you may know, I covered him in 1962 and 63 in the Deep South in some of the worst moments of the Civil Rights Movement. That a single gunman killed Dr. Martin Luther King, there's no question who did it. He was arrested and tried and convicted. There's no doubt in my mind, and I think the facts overwhelmingly shout, that this one person did it. However, the question has always been, was there anybody connected to him? I don't think this is the answer you're looking for. My own opinion, clearly labeled, is I don't think anyone directly put him up to it. That is, the Ku Klux Klan or some big money, old-time segregationist. However, I do think that he felt that if he committed this crime, that he would be hailed as a hero and made a very wealthy man, if you see what I mean. That was the motivation behind it. It was, you know, most unfortunate that the investigation was in some ways bungled. However, after having looked at it and looked at it very carefully over the years and run a really deep-seated journalistic investigation, that's where I come out on it.
All right. Dan, this week on HDNet, on your show, you're dealing with the Catholic Church. And the premise here is that back in the late 60s, it looks like a more liberal view of Catholicism might sort of shape things. That's not where things have gone.
No, it isn't. And let me say, I'm not a Roman Catholic. I'm a Protestant. But I have tremendous respect for the Church in many ways and the work that it does on a worldwide basis of helping people and carrying forward its basic mission. However, two things. We've done two stories about the Church. One, the unfortunate circumstance, and it is unfortunate, of how the church turned a blind eye to child sexual abuse for so long and is now still financially trying to duck and dodge that. We did one investigative report on that. The other report that we're doing is just what you described, that during the 1960s and during the time of Vatican, what's called Vatican II, the church opened up and became much more open, such things as the Mass being said in English or any other local language. There is a movement within the church now to move it back to a much more, by anybody's description, conservative position. And we've been investigating that and looking into it, and we're going to try to bring it to screen and explain to people what the issues are. It's a very deep-seated issue for the church itself. Whether one is Roman Catholic or not is somewhat beside the point, because the church being such a tremendous power in the world, including a power for good, what happens with the church affects just about everybody. So we've been investigating it for about a year, and we'll bring that to screen probably this next week.
It's going to be very powerful, and of course you get the time to do it on cable. You couldn't do on CBS, which is great. I've worked as a jury consultant, one of my other hats, in some priest abuse cases, and another time for a discussion about that, but it's an amazing. There's so much hypocrisy, Dan, that we live with in the world on the part of everybody. Politicians, religious folks, it's just what people say and what people do are often not in accord with each other.
Unfortunately, that's true.
But one person is in accord, and that is you, because you always say what you speak. Hey, let me pull a Chris Matthews before I let you go. Can you tell me something I don't know?
Tell you something you don't know. What a good question, and I should be prepared for that question. Well, I think that people may not know how much war profiteering there has been with the Iraq and Afghan wars. The war profiteering, both with American companies and with people who are indigenous to Iraq and Afghanistan, is a basically untold story. It's a disgusting story. War profiteering has run amok. The part of our problem in Afghanistan is we have backed a government in power. This is the government of President Karzai, which is corrupt to the core and inefficient. And tremendous sums of money have been made by war profiteers, including some Afghans, but also including a lot of Americans and a lot of American companies. And I think most Americans have no idea how much of the tremendous sums of money, to say nothing of the blood we spilled in both these places, but a tremendous sum of money has gone to war profiteers.
And more to come on that, I'm sure. The show, HDNet, it airs in Chicago on Comcast, on DirecTV, on Dish Network, AT&T, UVerse, Insight. It's everywhere. Hopefully you have Comcast, because that's what I appear on as well. But the legendary Dan Rather. Dan, I'm saying, unfortunately, I've got a board full of callers. We don't no time to talk to you. Please come back, would you?
I'll be happy to, Paul, and I really appreciate you having me on, and I want to wish you a Merry Christmas and the best new year you've ever had.
Well, again, an honor and pleasure and privilege to have you here. I wish you the warmest of holiday seasons ever, and my deep, deep thanks for joining me today. The legendary Dan Rather. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Paul.
Bye-bye. All right. Well, I told you it's a jam-packed show. It doesn't get any hotter, but we're going to take it a little bit hotter, because if you are familiar with a book called Radical Disciple, the story of Father Flager and St. Sabina's Church, his fight for social justice, well, it's a book you need to be reading. And joining me now online is the author of that book, and that's Robert McClory. Now, Robert is a journalist. He's a professor emeritus at Medill. That's over at Northwestern. He's a former Roman Catholic priest himself, and he's written this incredibly insightful book. Robert, I've read the book, and welcome to the Paul Lisnik Show, Robert McClory.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks for being with me. And I know we need to have more time. It's been a tight show today, and I know that we're gonna get you back here, actually, because we're trying to get Father Flager to also join you for an interview. We won't give up on that. We'll make that happen one day.
Good.
So in the book, and I have read it, you know, of course, you're talking primarily to Chicago here, so people are familiar with Father Flager, and we know his missions and what he's all about. What I loved in the book is getting some of the backstory and some of his, you know, his relationship with his mother, some other things that took him. What makes Father Flager tick? Let me just ask you that question.
Well, he has, I think, amazing integrity. He believes in the power of religion and the power of activism, and it's in his it's part of who he is. And a lot of people a lot of people, young people, come out with a good amount of optimism and energy in religion and in other callings. And after a while, you lose it. It diminishes. In his case, it has only increased over the years. He is just about ready right this month to begin his 30th year as the pastor of St. Sabina Church. And I see no diminishment or no loss of energy or zeal or determination on his part. And that's a rather extraordinary thing. You don't find that in any profession that I know. It's a rarity, and he has it. He has had it from the beginning, and continues to think that you can make a difference in this world. And most people get burned out.
And you know, it's funny. We kind of almost take his presence at St. Sabina's for granted. But when you read this book, you realize that early on, when he first got there, there was every intention to get rid of him. I mean, he was not going to stay there, right?
Well, people like him have a way of antagonizing superiors because they have their own way of doing it. They're determined to get it done, and they're not easily intimidated. It's the same spirit, I think, that animated the prophets of the Bible, and the same spirit that has animated down through the centuries the Christian prophets, the great leaders in Christianity, that they are always ahead of the people, ahead of the leadership, certainly, and that tends to cause a lot of tension and difficulties.
Early on when he was at the church, and of course one of the senior priests died, and one of the great stories you tell, I'll just be very brief with it, but in the end, I guess the church sort of said, okay, we need to have this ceremony in the morning, and he said, wait a minute, but you know, the parishioners, the African-Americans who are in this community, they're working in the morning, they can't come to a morning thing, we need to
That's
do
right.
this at night, and they said, well, no, it's not going to be, so he held two services, one in the morning, where nobody but a few priests showed up, and then one at night, where the whole community came.
Yep.
His success is about understanding his parish and his community.
That's right. That's right. He understands the people. And this is another thing that is unique, I think, about him, that he isn't that kind of leader who figures out in his own mind exactly what needs to be done and then insists on everybody following. But he has always been, from the beginning, a kind of collaborative person. And he wanted to know what kind of worship service is best suited for an African-American community, and what kind of ministries should the church be doing in a neighborhood with the difficulties and the complications that are present in his neighborhood there around 79th and Racine. So it was always, there was always a lot of research going on, as well as this incredible leadership. So he was not leading from way out in front. He was leading in the midst of people and what they wanted and what they thought.
And you talk about leadership. There's a quote in the book when he was after getting the billboards down that deal with selling cigarettes and alcohol and all that, and he's dealt with drug dealers. And one of his comments was, and you quote him, "I'm not really afraid," Flager said. "If you're in a leadership position, you've got to lead. If you're concerned about my safety, then you better come out, stand by me, and march with me."
Yeah.
He just does what's right.
Yeah, he has followed that pattern, and he's been amazingly successful in that. You know, this is a church, a parish that is really rare anywhere in the United States or in the world, as far as I know, where we have a huge percentage, and it's not the majority certainly, but a huge percentage of the people that go to that church, that profess to be members of that church, are extremely active in one or more of the ministries. And these are ministries that aren't just, you know, doing kind of nice things or preparing food baskets. They do that for sure. But the ministries that require going out and getting on a bus and going down to Springfield to protest or to advocate for some issue before the legislature, or going down to City Hall and marching, There's a huge number of people that are motivated and continue to be motivated
and
by
that's
that kind of activism.
And that's what makes the difference. I received some emails, by the way, or some messages. I mentioned you were going to be on the show. You did a book signing today, and there were some folks there who bought your book and met you, and they commented to me saying they were going to listen in tonight because they had just met you. But let me just ask you while we have a moment, next book signing, anything coming up in the area we need to know about?
Well, tomorrow at after the 10 o'clock Unity service at St. Sabina, we're going to have a book signing down in the McMahon Hall in the downstairs below the church.
All right, so that's tomorrow, December 5th, after services.
That would be around 1:30.
All right. Is there a website that people can just check you out, Robert, to see what other signings are coming up?
Well, we've run out of signings right now for the remainder of the year. But there are a lot coming up in January and February.
A website that's where people can find out what they are?
Yes. They're not up on the website.
No, but when they are, just go ahead and give us the website.
You can look at Radical Disciple is a website for the book.
Okay.
And all of the activities are on that and will be on that. Weeks ahead of time.
All right. Did Father Flager, looks like he helped you with the book because it's certainly a very positive portrayal. Was he supportive of your project?
Absolutely. He was very supportive in his own way. He gave me a hard time when I said, I want to do this book. And he was reluctant at first. And then he turned around and said, okay, I will cooperate. But he says, I will give you only 1 hour at a time. And
good luck trying to find that hour.
you like, a kind of a longer period. So I went out there to St. Sabina Church. I live in Evanston.
Right.
And I went out there over a period of 2 years a lot of times.
To get those times. I know we're out of time, Robert, here as well. And I know getting him to sit down for an hour is tough. It was tough to arrange to get him on our show. We almost did, and there were some scheduling issues. But promise me that you'll come back. I want to go through this again and do it with you and Father Flager, and we'll look forward to doing that in the new year.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
The book is Radical Disciple, Father Flager, St. Sabina Church, and The Fight for Social Justice, the author, Robert McClory. Robert, thanks so much. Have a very Merry Christmas and Happy Holiday.
Thanks. Same to you.
All right, bye-bye. All right. Thanks for joining us today. My thanks to my guest, Marlo Thomas, and pick up her book for Christmas, Growing Up Laughing, to legendary newsman Dan Rather. Be sure to watch his show on HDNet and, of course, to Robert McClory on his book, Radical Disciple. A jam-packed show, a great show with those great guests. And thank you all for listening. My thanks to Melody Spann Cooper, Todd Ronskowski for being with me, Robert for hanging over there at the board and working with me. And holidays are almost here, so we'll just say happy holidays. This is the Paul Lisnick Show here on the Talk of Chicago, 1690 WVON.